Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls' weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We are seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 123, section 2, paragraph 3. It's our arc, Jesus of Nazareth. All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. His acts being in seven stages, man at first is the infant, then the whining schoolboy, then the lover, then a soldier, then justice, then spectacles on the nose and pouch on the side. Last scene of all is second childishness. That's from Shakespeare. It's a different list of some stages of man through his life. We'll cover something like that tonight, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. With us tonight, Dr. Chris Halverson, David Tucker, Justin Armstrong, and of course you. We're glad that you're here. Won't you join us in our study? Call up the text of the Urantia book as you see fit and settle in for 1% of your week with us. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Master Brad, there, the bard. It's great to have you bring in Shakespeare occasionally. Good evening to you, Justin, and Dave, and everyone who's joined us again this evening. As Brad was pointing out, we're jumping into the interior of a section. We got started with the so-called fifth year. Now, we'll start with the midwares explaining why they're calling it the fifth year, and sixth year and the seventh year, and et cetera. But we're sort of officially in the stream now of how they present the maturation of Jesus of Nazareth, taking it basically 1 year at a time, a few expansions in the midst of it, that eventually we get to those papers where they spread the discussion out a little bit to focus on some of the bigger issues. But as Brad was pointing out, you know, just having sequences like that, the whole arc here is very much reading a sequence of sections. Even you could say an enumerated sequence of sections. In terms of thinking about how God's creative act not only manifests in the macro as an overall evolutionary process of the universe of universes, but how that is expressed in micro, in each of us as individuals, where our ontogeny recapitulates that phylogeny. There is a creating of Jesus of Nazareth, not as a magical single finger snap, but as a very definitive, logical, sequential series of unfolding events. And so just everything about the revelation, no matter what topic you're approaching, is designed to try to get you to recognize the hand of God, the habit of God, the law of God that precisely unfolds everything, and to find the beauty of creation in the logic of a sequence. So try to kind of keep that as one of the many things that I've kind of pointed out as overarching concepts to keep in mind as we expand on Jesus's life here.
Well, thank you for that, Chris. Thanks for the lovely little teeing up and the introduction to the material, the framing of it. I know for me, as the years have gone on here on Symmetry of Soul, as my study has deepened, and hopefully my religious life has been quickened and deepened, whatever you will, I have found it easier to see that hand of God, and hopefully to have this mode of living that is religion. Hopefully I'm getting more and more out of that thing where religion was just a series of acts that I did. It's sort of getting shot through everything these days, and including reading the book. So It's the proper way to interpret this book. So, yeah, thank you for that. And David, good evening to you. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, Brad. I'm doing very well. Hello, Justin, and hello, Dr. Chris. I've got my sandal straps all laced up. really looking forward to these early years of the master, because I've began going through the archives on PHI Library and starting at the foreword and had a whole bunch of holes poked into my worldview. And so it's good to start off fresh with some lessons from the master's early years and how a beginning budding individual could look upon these things with fresh eyes.
Mm. Well said. Yeah. We're glad that you're here, David. You know, we've had a little bit of changing up of some of our rotations and our co-hosts air these last few months, and really glad to have you here. You bring a wonderful vitality and energy to the program, and we're glad that you're here. We're also, Justin, glad that you're here. You've also bring your own unique talents to the show, and how are you doing this evening, sir?
I'm well. Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Dr. Chris. Good evening, David. This fifth year, being a parent myself, there's something about this time in terms of development that was extremely rewarding for me, and I'm really looking forward to studying it with all of you this evening.
All right. Well, we'll get to that in just a moment, but first I will attempt to remind us where we were at last week. Got a little bit of a summary here. So to begin with, I thought, how would I sum up our pre-reading discussion, and I decided it was the word travesty. The discussion was about travesties. So once upon a time, maybe you're like me, you read paper 4, section 5, paragraph 6, and agreed with the revelators that it's a travesty, quote-unquote, to put salvation into a human-conceived theologic concept frame like the atonement doctrine. Well, fine if you did that, but while we're talking about travesties, how about that popular burlesque act lately where the truths of the Urantia book are put into the secular humanistic concept frame? That's just another human-conceived concept frame. Or worse, how about that thing where you distort the Urantia book teachings to fit your individual wishful notions of salvation? Things like, oh, I'm a nice person, and that's good enough to get to paradise. These are travesties, or worse yet, some of them may be blasphemies. Why? Because salvation is still on God's terms. It always has been, including for a million years of human history here on our world. The Urantia papers do nothing to overturn this. They uphold this truth. They reveal new elements, yes, but they don't throw out that which must be conserved. Salvation is on God's terms, not human terms. The fifth epical revelation is a revelation, not affirmation. You should be a truth seeker, not an affirmation seeker. Are you actually reading the Urantia book? Or, like me when I was younger, did you sort of turn off your brain after paper 4, section 5, paragraph 6, and just sort of bask in the travesty of it all? Well, now you need to read the entire book. It's a synthetic wholeness. And speaking of how to use your time, are you using that one talent of time given to you well? That's from paper 28. Remember, in paper 28, they say you must ensure your survival. And time is all that we are given. Use it well. This one thing is important to do with your time. Ensure your survival. And we talked about how you can rest assured that you have not used your time well if you've lived your life as if salvation has something to do with schemes, activities, or dances in the outer life, or you lived your life as if salvation is automatic. Say it with me. Lucifer said that. Salvation's not automatic. All right, then we talked about how we might consider this arc that we just sallied forth on starting last week. Jesus was a human boy, not the magical fetish man of New Testament Apocrypha. No, he was Jesus the man, Jesus of Nazareth, starting out life as a baby just like we do. So this story restored to us in the Urantia papers is immensely relevant for us. It illuminates the truth of our human life, what our human life really is. If you want an entertaining story about a boy, read The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. If you want a boy's story that can help you and your family's life, study Jesus' childhood. As you read this, as we read this in this arc, consider, number one, how did Jesus ensure his eternal survival? How do any of us ensure our survival? Number two, was Jesus raised in a religious household? Number three, what role did his mother and father play? What about his neighborhood environment? And number four, what are we to do when we read what appears to be just a random factoid, we called it? Why would the revelators really tell us something like Joseph's resume? Is that random, or are they revealing a truth about a father who's providing a stable family setting? All right, so then we started in paper 123, The Early Childhood of Jesus. We see Joseph and Mary complement one another as parents. There must be a balance in a marriage of place likeness, that's the female influence, and direction likeness, that's the male influence. But, you know, today we live in times where many regard male and female as equivalent or interchangeable, but they're not. There's a reason male and female have the hardwired instincts that they do. Male and female exist in the cosmos because they are necessary. They're necessary here below as well as on high. If male and female were not necessary, they wouldn't exist. Reality is mind-planned, mind-made, and mind-administered, from paper 42. It is neither arbitrary nor random, as materialists would contend. Joseph and Mary considered raising Jesus in Alexandria and Bethlehem, both powerful political cities or towns. But Jesus didn't need politics and power. He needed ethics and religion, paper 195. Joseph and Mary debated the matter of Bethlehem for 3 weeks, deciding on a wise course. We noticed it takes time. As experiential creatures, we usually can determine the right only by the deduction of the wrong. We observed how Joseph and Mary, quote, overcame this matter, suggesting the superadditive consequence available when two opposing viewpoints are honestly debated and reconciled by two children of God, especially a husband and wife. And it's okay to be, quote, outspoken, as Joseph was, in your views. This modern fashion of avoiding all conflict will produce no superadditive consequence. Then we noted that a helpless infant needs many helpful influences. They need help with everything. And we saw that one basic helpful item was Jesus' parents selecting who was, quote, acceptable for him to play with. Speaking of which, is your hometown actively hostile to raising your family in a godly, healthy, nurturing environment? Does the culture there insist on little to no differential between male and female? Does it reject reality by rebelling against that which is plainly reality? Does it therefore reject God? If so, you might consider moving. A child's entire afterlife is enormously influenced by the cultural waters in which they swim. And, you know, it may not be easy to discuss these kinds of things these days. It's bound to stir up conflict, even amongst our longtime listeners. I get that. Please understand that here on Symmetry of Soul, this is not some ideological agenda or political axe grinding. It's simply recognizing what is innate in reality with the aid of the clear light of an epical revelation. Then we get to section one back in Nazareth. Joseph and Mary experienced, quote, supreme happiness because they had a positive response to a negative stimulus. We've heard that before here on Symmetry of Soul. They exhibited adaptability and wisdom in their plans. Notice how often the word wisdom is used in this paper. We can aspire to do this as well. Consider how wise it was of them to resist the urge to tell everyone Jesus was a child of promise and get those Messiah expectant people all whipped up in his hometown. Then we saw Jesus spending time on a farm and in a practical workshop at a young age. We were reminded how important it is for a child to have a grounding in the facts of natural reality. It's essential, yes, to have a hunger that produces a perfectingness of goodness, yes, but you must also have a foundation of fact, fact, truth, goodness. Then we spent a bit of time talking about how the fifth epical revelation validates that human mental development has average milestones around ages 3, 8, 12, 16, and 20. Science has speculated on such things, but because there are statistical distributions around these ages, and also because we're prone to overanalysis, This has not been clear to us, but the revelators help clear up the waters here. If you approach the fifth epical revelation in that synthesizing mode, that is, it was suggested that even the very papers in our present study arc are laid out along these lines of these developmental milestones. Note, for example, how paper 123 covers ages 3 to 8 in Jesus' life. We also noted the textual implication, quote, unusual mental activity, thus implying that the fifth adjutant mind spirit may have connected with Jesus before the age of 3. So we reminded ourselves that Jesus here is fully human, yes, but he's precocious. As we read, we'll bear in mind that he isn't in the middle of the bell curve of average human developmental stages. Then we just started section 2. We'll continue it here this evening. Section 2, the fifth year. Again, we see that Jesus is precocious. He receives a thought adjuster over a year earlier than the average of our day and age. If we assume Jesus got an adjuster about as early as could be possible, we can invert that math, and we might conclude that basically all children these days will have an adjuster by age 8. That's about as far as we made it into section 2, and that ends the summary.
Excellent.
Thank you, Brad.
Yeah, that was fantastic, Brad. Really, really well done.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. It was a delight to put that one together. That one wasn't quite as harrowing as the previous one. Don't never know why. Not quite sure what's up. Probably my stormy interior weather. But any comments or things to clarify?
Yeah, just one point to, towards the end. As we look for this kind of breaking up of one's development into these stages of, you know, up to 3, and then from 3 up to 8, and from 8 up to 12, et cetera. When I was talking about that, you know, that first stage, you know, it may not be that, you know, Jesus got his fifth adjutant, you know, that much earlier. You know, it may be that he got it very much right around 3, and as I was pointing out, that's, the fact that they bring that up and the way they speak of it in the revelation, you know, makes you suspicious that that's what that first stage is about. That the, you know, the infant stage is really getting your 5 animal adjutants.
Right, right.
And then you go, you know, into you know, the super animal mode. You know, or initially you could say the supra-animal mode, you know, immediately above the animal and eventually fully above the animal to being a human with 7 adjutants and an encirclement in the Holy Spirit and the identification of a personality.
Right.
Okay, so, you know, obviously we could, you know, we could speculate that Jesus's genetics, you know, being carefully selected like it was, you know, might make him, you know, getting certain of those first 5 adjutants, you know, a little bit, you know, earlier in the, you know, the bell curve of humans getting those first 5 adjutants. But, you know, the specifics there of them saying unusual mental activity,
mm-hmm. right?
You know, is the issue of what happens once you have the 5? You know, and you're, as it were, quivering on the very brink of getting 6 and 7 and the encirclement in the Holy Spirit. And you know, I think that's where you can suspect that they're mostly focusing the use of that word unusual is, you know, is him, you know, getting from the fifth, you know, pretty much, you know, in the 8-3 ballpark like everyone else, but then very rapidly relative to, you know, the distribution, getting all the way to the seventh adjutant.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, for that being, like you pointed out, so much in advance of, you know, 5 years, 10 months, you know, sort of thing, you know, roughly age six. You know, and see, in that, you know, that sort of amping up of the animal mind, being, you know, being so aggressive, if you will, you know, that you know, he's going to naturally have a very lean into it temperament because of that. I mean, he's, yeah, he's you know, you could say he's spiritually precocious. And so, you know, as you, and you can, you know, as you continue to read, as we're going to do tonight, you know, when you see what aspects of his early life they bring up, it, you know, most of it is in that, is in that sense of, you know, he has, you know, these budding human tendencies, you know, sooner or to a degree, you know, greater than the run-of-the-mill, you know, child.
Yeah. That makes sense.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. But,
yeah.
But the basic sort of animal foundation, you know, is going to get laid. I mean, what he does with that animal foundation, okay, you know, subsequently, you know, is again going to be precocious.
Oh, sure.
But yeah. But yeah. So I think that's, you know, that's the key, you know, is how unusually mentally active he is for someone, you know, even with, you know, the genetic selection that went on, you know, and even with 2,000 years going forward to us today, you know, we didn't get the biologic uplift, we didn't get, you know, the management of the herd, as it were, by the prince's staff and whatnot, and you know, so, you know, we're very limited genetically in general, and to see someone that's, you know, kind of hinting at, you know, a genetics that's not quite commensurate with, you know, our lowly estate, you know, see, that's unusual. You know, it wouldn't be unusual, you know, if you go to a normal world in the post-Bestowal Sun Age, you know, I mean, he would probably deem to be, you know, slow.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
You know, and like, yeah, we've talked about, if you go to, you know, a world enlightened life, I mean, you know, they wouldn't even let any of us breathe, you know. They wouldn't let Jesus of Nazareth, you know, even breathe on the planet. He's just a contagion, okay, biologically. Okay.
Crazy to think about, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, there's that relativity. But, yeah, the important thing is not how unusual he was as an animal, but how unusual he was as a budding human.
Right. I found myself wondering, as I kind of pre-read for this whole arc, what's the interplay? You know, in terms of Jesus, we keep using the word precocious. There's maybe just no better word for it. His developmental, you know, he, as they say at the end of this arc, sorry to spoil it, he did all these things before he was 30. I think that's right at the end of the arc. That's phenomenal. Most of us are, you know, barely getting our britches on straight by the time we're 30 these days. And like, was it, so, you know, Jesus, clearly it was a combination of the times he lived in, the culture he lived in, his genetics, his upbringing, his early, you know, childhood, his experienced thought adjuster. Like there are all these, and plus just supremacy, just overall, like the way things need to be. It's just fascinating to think about, if is there any way to disentangle those, or, you know, and so what does it mean insofar as what does it mean for us? I find myself thinking about.
Well, I mean, you know, the truth of his life are the truths of eternity. And so the time difference between how things rolled out for him and how they would roll out for us is irrelevant to the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair point.
You know, I mean, we even have an old tale about a tortoise and a hare. to try to teach kids, you know, a little bit of that truth. You know, it's about the quality, you know, not how fast you get there. So you can note, you know, the precociousness, okay, but you know the speed at which he's developing is not the truth of his life. That's just a fact of time.
Right.
But the sequence, right, the logical sequence, see, that's getting to the truth of his life. As I was saying up front, there is a truth to all of our lives because all of us, when all is said and done, are ultimately the product of creation. No matter how much that isn't, you know, apparent in an immediate temporal sense, you know, that, Chris wasn't there, and then someone snapped their magic fingers, and then poof, Chris was there. Okay, it's not like that. But, everything, is manifesting because of a creative will that is absolute and infinite. And hence, nothing is separate. The minutest detail is not separate from that fact. You know, all is a creation. And you can tell that because if you develop the insight, you see the logic that's inescapably there. So you know it's being created, and it's not just somehow magically bubbling up into existence.
Yeah, no, I get that. That makes sense.
You know, every time I began to study this part of the book in Jesus's early age, and I can recall even the first time I read about how an adjuster comes to a child, it makes me think about my own childhood. And I was not raised in a religious family. I didn't even have a safe environment. I had a lot of negativity and even violence in my life as a child. And however, one time I recall, and I always think about this, and I know this probably wasn't the time that the adjuster came, but I remember watching some preacher on TV, and it's hard not to get emotional about this, but he had said, you know, if you want Jesus in your heart, call on the show, and we will pray, and Jesus will come to your heart. And I just was so taken back by that I just begged my mom. She was doing dishes at the time, and I was like yanking on her shirt and her pants. I'm like dragging her to the phone. And back then we had the phone that had a long old cable. You could take it through several rooms of your house and get it tangled all the way through. And I just remember dragging it to the living room and asking her, can I call? And she was like, okay, Mijo, go ahead. You can call. And I called, and he got me right on the air, and he prayed over me. And it's just it's still such a vivid picture. And I don't, you know, of course, I don't think that was when my adjuster came, but I just remember having this impulse, this urge at a very early age that I had no business having that. And yet infinity found me. And I just, it's so precious to me.
How important that is. To be in an environment where there are religionists, you know, and how God's creative act unfolding in you, you know, is by design sensitive to that presence of religionists and will respond positively to it. And so, it's an important favorable condition to religious growth. is to have just, even if those around you aren't directly engaging you in any way, just their presence there speaks to you, right? There's a loyalty to God that you're immersed in. And you will respond to that because you're designed to.
Well, that thank you for sharing that, Dave. That's moving just by proxy to hear that. I can almost see this little David there in the household with the long. I can definitely see the long 1980s tangled cord. I remember those. This is something Ruthie and I, of course, were thinking about with our family hopes. It's like what sorts of ways to make the household a religious place, other than, you know, you hope it'll be your mode of living. It'll just seep through your pores to where it doesn't just have to come through a television screen. I'm so grateful that TV screen was there for you, David. What sorts of things to have around the house? What opportunities, you know, little serendipitous opportunities to have so that the child can find this, you know, quite on their own? You're providing the favorable conditions. You're not inducing the growth yourself. You're not, you know, whipping them so that they grow.
Yeah.
You know, regarding those opportunities.
Okay.
I was just going to state that at the very final sentence of 123:1 from last week's study, there's the statement, they did not return to Nazareth for more than 2 months. Jesus greatly enjoyed this, his first experience on a farm. And I was mentioning that there was a reference somewhere to the beauty of nature, and I wanted to share it with everyone since I did find it after the show. It's from 167:6, and there's two little statements I want to read. The first one is, the child should be introduced to worship in nature's outdoors, and later accompany his parents to public houses of religious assembly, which are at least as materially attractive and artistically beautiful as the home in which he is daily domiciled. And in that section, they also reference that beauty is most religious when it is most simple and nature-like. So one of those opportunities is clearly referenced here in the Revelation in terms of allowing children to find the beauty of nature. And Jesus responded greatly. He enjoyed greatly that experience of being in nature on the farm.
Yeah. You know, I mean, again, there's many, many favorable conditions to religious growth. Trying to talk at the same time you were there, I was just going to point out a simple little sentence there, you know, in paper 100, right, in that section on religious growth, right, where you've got the tadpole and whatnot. When it says religious habits of thinking and acting are contributory to the economy of spiritual growth, relative to what I was saying a minute ago, right, about, religionists in your environment. Notice that they use the word economy there, of spiritual growth. Yeah, economy literally means the laws of the house. Whether that house is literally the family's house, right, or, the community's quote-unquote house, right? You're raised in a house of the laws of God, right? They're just, the laws are the predicate to the literal structure of the family's home, of the community's village. And that unspoken presence of just being surrounded by a world that's ordered by the recognition of God. Right? It speaks the truth that's where order comes from, And, in eternity there is infinite, perfect order because there's God. So those are powerful, basic messages. Like I said, that don't have to be acted out in any conscious way. They don't have to be spoken. They just are. And you're within that presence.
Yeah. Well, plenty to think about there. Particularly, our home is something we have control over. In the United States here, under the freedoms that we enjoy and hopefully can continue to enjoy. But if you're in a wider neighborhood or community where they're adopting that secular attitude of, they're affirming you don't need God, you cannot, unlike in Jesus' time, you cannot look to the community to provide those religious habits of thinking. You'll have to ingrain those in your home and maybe your church, maybe a school, homes, churches, and schools. But, see to it. If you want to raise a religionist, and I hope that all of us here listening have raised religionists or would want to, speaking for myself.
You've got to raise someone who hungers and thirsts for righteousness. That's all you have to do. Everything else will take care of itself. But you have to see to that they come, as they begin to bud into a young person, that they have a hunger and a thirst for righteousness.
Right.
And everything else will come in due time.
That's that trust, yeah.
But you can't assume that will just happen, right, without stimulation, right, without favorable conditions. That hunger and thirst. Again, that ensuring your survival. I mean, if you have a hunger and thirst, you'll survive. Right? If you're the Pharisee in the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, right? If you don't hunger and thirst, well, then you don't survive.
Yeah.
It's the basics is, it's not complicated. Right? There isn't some, that was always the problem, with revelators trying to get man. It's like, no, stop complicating it.
Schemes.
It's not some, elaborate, endlessly wheels within wheels of minutiae that you have to dot every I and cross every T in order to gain God's favor. Okay. But, even though, in truth it's simple and straightforward, it's nonetheless wholly unnatural. It has to be chosen. It won't just choose itself.
Secularism is natural, ironically. In all of our would-be sophistication these days, thinking we're building an artful civilization, we're falling back into our man's natural preplanetary prince estate, just what comes naturally in the moment. Yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously, just the secular, right, is obviously natural, just the merely being a temporal experiential fact. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take that animal origin secular fact and you encircle it in the Holy Spirit and give it a personality, but don't properly stimulate it, then those augmentations of the animal turn the secular into an ism.
Right.
Secularism. Right. And so as you're saying, the secular is natural because of your animal origin. The secularism is inescapable and is natural, right? In the human that is not properly framed, not properly conditioned, is conditioned unfavorably.
When you touch upon it, it has to be chosen. Last week in 123:2, we read that Jesus arrived at the age of his first personal and wholehearted moral decision, and there came to abide with him a thought adjuster, a divine gift of the Paradise Father, and we've often touched upon the uniqueness of a conscious or an unconscious first moral decision in regards to the specificity of the arrival of the adjuster and the birth of the embryonic soul. But one of the thoughts that comes to mind is thinking about this conscious or unconscious choice in the context of faith or being born again. And when I think about sort of the process of faith, establishing faith or a faith grasp or being born again, I often think about it from the bottom up. And I think of this sequence of moving through the three cosmic intuitions. And basically, when you get to that third cosmic intuition, the recognition of spirit values, you have this personality grasp that's able to then engage that divine ministry. And it's in that faith grasp that there's the process of being born again. But then there's also this, in terms of the unconscious side, there's also this example of the Damascus Road and sort of Saul, for instance, having this top-down almost engagement where you take this reference of no one can see the kingdom of God unless he's born again, and Saul goes blind, and there's this sort of a top-down influence. It's almost as if he unconsciously made a supreme decision, but it wasn't in his conscious mind. And I guess my question is, when it comes to a conscious or an unconscious decision outside of just the context of an adjuster, is it possible that there's the choice can be made from the top down, where it's unconsciously you're born again in the instance of Saul, where it seems like on the surface or in the appearance he was born again without consciously moving in that direction?
I'll go too far afield here. I mean,
sure,
that
sure,
gets
sure.
into the whole complexities of the historical confusions about conversion events, you know, that, you know, the relator mm-hmm. spent a lot of time in various spots in the book talking about that issue. Okay, but just to keep it simple and immediate here, you know, the first thing you brought up there was, you know, that initial unconscious choice. You know, when a personality that's not yet identified to a selfhood, right, chooses that selfhood, right? You know, that's that, you know, it's that act of the personality identifying to your selfhood, you know, at roughly age 6 for us, right, or a lot earlier for Jesus, you know, that precipitates eventually an adjuster showing up once it, you know, goes through the check-in line on Uversa. getting an adjuster is not securing your salvation.
Sure.
I mean, that's just making it, you know, possible that you know your thoughts about salvation aren't delusional, right? I bet I can survive even without an adjuster. No, okay, you don't have a soul. There's nothing to survive. So when we're talking about, you know, and I'm saying you have to choose. This is very much. It doesn't have to be, you know, a dramatic conversion event choice.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, it can be like Jesus, right, sort of, you know, the reciprocal of Paul in this, you know, in this choice. You know, but it nonetheless is very definitive, right? I mean, you know, the key is to kind of think about existentially, you have this definitive sort of, you know, totality of choice, but how does that play out in time? When you take that existential choice and you express it down in time, you know, is it spread out over a, you know, a long stretch of time, like with Jesus, or is it, you know, kind of scrunched into a very short span of time, like with Paul? Okay. Yeah, remember, fundamentally, you know, decisions are temporal and choices are eternal,
yes,
if you will, right? You know, you are, and how that choice, you know, that is sort of temporally, not present. How does the shadow of that play down into time? In the case of Jesus, the preface to the final paper, to paper 196, is very long.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That choice is this very definitive, inexorable phenomenon, minute element by minute element inexorably just comes into full flower. Without any, dramatic emotional suddenlies. But not everyone is like that.
Right.
And anyway, we're talking about choosing, securing your salvation, I mean, we're talking about it, we're not talking about something that just kind of creeps up on you, you are consciously involved. Just don't think that, that this has to somehow be a singular moment, right, that you're consciously involved, right?
More of a consecration than a decision in time. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It just, in the case of someone like Paul, I mean, you see, it was all building up in the background, and he just sort of, brought it into play in a, definitive, spectacular moment. But in case of Jesus, it wasn't, as soon as it was sort of in, building up within him, he brought it into play, right then, right? And so it didn't build up into one spectacular glob all at once.
It is a variable process. Yeah. I appreciate the way the Revelators kind of point that out. Certainly, I remember, paper 196, comparing it with the Damascus Road incident with Saul. But elsewhere, the whole section on conversion and mysticism, they just say, your mileage may vary. They don't put it that way, but I don't know. I'm just thinking of, we'll get to the reading. I just wanted to share, Ruthie and I, we attend a church that you would call a seeker church. They're very interested in new members joining and getting them baptized quickly. And, at the baptistry is right outside, and usually someone gets baptized every weekend. And you can see a lot of different things going on with the people who are baptized. I mean, some of them are having amazing, outrageous emotional reactions, but I've lived long enough. I can I don't know, that feels ecstatic, but the water was also a little chilly, so it may have just been an emotional reaction. Time will give it the proof. But we'll see if they're back for their annual baptism next year. All the way
was
to people who are like
shudder or just a temperature shudder.
Shudder. All the way to the other extreme of people who are like, huh, well, that was it. I guess I thought there would be fireworks and sparks. You can see them kind of walk away like, huh, I'm not sure I feel any different. I mean, the key is what you said, Justin, I think, there's this consecration. There should be a sincerity behind it. And don't look to the water. That is a finite moment. And don't look to overinterpreting that as a magical bit of water or like you allegorizing Jesus' death and put in the tomb and then resurrected in 3 days. I mean, people love to do that with baptism as well. See to it that there's a consecration and that you're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, because of our, scientific education today relative to, times gone by, fewer and fewer people, have a very magical sensibility about water.
Right.
I mean, if everyone thinks of water kind of in, the way baptism was initiated into the Christian tradition, and others before that, if you think about that water in very magical fashion, and, you're very definitive about that, almost every person is going to have a very conscious, dramatic change happen to them subjectively, right? At the point of baptism, because you literally believe that it's magic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you make that magic appear to be real, right? By, the identification to it with your mind. But, when water is, less of a mystical, magical substance, right, in modern times, right? Yeah, it's not to mention, you know, if you do it with an infant, right?
Right.
You know, all the infant knows is, you know, now he's not comfortable, kind of like the same way when he, you know, when his diaper needs to be changed. So it's, you know, rather not what you're, you know, imagining. It's some incredible mystical phenomenon, right? but anyway, you know, just, you know, what we're trying to do is, you know, is stand above the various mystical and, you know, magical and theological rationalizations about all this. And, you know, the fifth epical revelation is designed to help us to see the truth that's there despite the confusing attempts for ignorant humans to interpret things.
Indeed. All right. Well, I suggest we get on with the reading here. Let's get to it. We are, thank you for the conversation. That was wide-ranging and delightful, and whoever's going to get to summarize that has their work cut out for them. So, not me, not it. Okay. All right. We are in paper 123 of the Urantia Papers, The Early Childhood of Jesus. We are picking up in section 2, the fifth year, 2 B.C., and we are at the third paragraph in that section, which is on page 1357 of the original single-column publication of these papers. Jesus was 5 years old in August of this year, and we will therefore refer to this as his fifth calendar year of life. In this year, 2 BC, a little more than 1 month before his fifth birthday anniversary, Jesus was made very happy by the coming of his sister Miriam, who was born on the night of July 11. During the evening of the following day, Jesus had a long talk with his father concerning the manner in which various groups of living things are born into the world as separate individuals. The most valuable part of Jesus' early education was secured from his parents in answer to his thoughtful and searching inquiries. Joseph never failed to do his full duty in taking pains and spending time answering the boy's numerous questions. From the time Jesus was 5 years old until he was 10, he was one continuous question mark. While Joseph and Mary could not always answer his questions, they never failed fully to discuss his inquiries and in every other possible way to assist him in his efforts to reach a satisfactory solution of the problem which his alert mind had suggested.
Okay, so there's a couple different elements in there. Let me just start with a little bit of a technical aside. I was holding off until we read this paragraph. We were definitely starting to see it last time when they told us about Jesus's next sibling is brother James's birth, and here we have his sister Miriam, and in both cases, one can notice that they just tell you what year it is, and what month, and what day of the month, but they don't tell you what day of the week it is. And for people who have heard me bring this up many times over the years, over the decades now, this is an issue that I address in a little paper I wrote a long time ago called "When Is Jesus' Birthday?" That you can find in the Perfecting Horizons Library. And one of the points that I bring up in there, that kind of was the what got me going on laying out that paper, is you notice a very curious fact in the Revelation that every single B.C. event, event that's in B.C., where they give you a specific month and day, they don't tell you what day of the week it is, Sunday, Tuesday, Friday, whatever. But the moment that you get to A.D., they do. Basically, every single time they mention a specific thing, after that they give you what day of the week it is. Why don't they give you the day of the week for James and Miriam's birthdays, then they give the day of the week for every other, you know, brother and sister? And they don't even give you the day of the week for Jesus.
No.
That's a BC day. And so if I'm not going to, you know, go into it, if you're curious about why that is, right, it involves a little bit of a calendar science, if you will, to sort that out, and that's what I do in that little paper entitled "When Is Jesus' Birthday?" But you know, we'll shortly get to, you know, the next child, and ta-da! There's the day of the week. You'll see. So it's very obvious once you notice it.
You know, one thing that stands out to me regarding James in comparison to Miriam. You'll notice when the designation they used regarding James was Jesus was thrilled by the thought of having a baby brother, and this is prior to the encirclement and the Holy Spirit and the arrival of the adjuster. However, after having his adjuster, when they're speaking of Miriam, they say Jesus was made very happy by the coming of his sister Miriam, and you have joy as one of the fruits of the Spirit. We've talked much about happiness and how transcendent that is of a word in regards
to
mere
joy.
Yeah.
Like a thrill thing. Right?
So he could potentially have happiness upon the arrival of Miriam, where they use the designation thrilled, because it's not possible in the context of his brother James.
Yeah, right. That whole ability to have a quote-unquote positive response to a negative stimulus, you know, or a negative environment, you know, in many ways. This is not a wealthy family, and it's 2,000 years ago and kind of a backwaters place. And, yeah, there's lots of difficulties to life. But if you use your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, you know, that's identified by your personality, you can be happy in the face of all that.
Yes.
Notice it doesn't say Jesus was very happy. It says Jesus was made.
Made. Yeah.
Very happy, right? And that's the thing about happiness. You know, it's an actual willful response. To a certain, you know, state of affairs, you know, externally.
Wow.
There's a stimulus response, but it's not, just an animal stimulus response, you know, that's natural. It's a human response to that stimulus. It can be unnatural.
Yeah. It's a great catch, Justin. Thanks. I totally missed that.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. It's great that I didn't have to. Did you notice that? Very good. And then the other thing I wanted to point out, I mean, because this will play out the rest of the stuff we read tonight, but you know, just bringing it in right up front here. Notice the scientific curiosity that is so immediately in play.
Yes.
That's kind of unusual. And we were talking about the unusual thing. Right? You know, you see this child beginning to manifest, a nature that's, not something that an animal does. Right? It's very definitively the result of him being encircuited now. And how key this is to religious growth, because I ended up going there before when we were talking. You know, go there again. Go to this section in paper 100, section 1 on religious growth. And go to that fifth paragraph, the paragraph after the tadpole paragraph. You know, the one that has our oft repeated second favorable condition, the humble one in it, after the loyal one in the tadpole paragraph. Okay, what other favorable conditions besides humility do they bring up in that, that next paragraph? So, see, the paragraph starts out The soil essential for religious growth presupposes a progressive, et cetera. Okay, but that predicate there, the soil essential for religious growth presupposes. Okay, that's mm-hmm. You can almost put a colon there, right? And then you have a list. See? And so one of those favorable conditions, right, the soil essential for religious growth. Notice, you have the progressive life of self-realization, and you have the coordination of natural propensities. But then what do you have? You've got this scientific curiosity mm-hmm. that we're talking about, the exercise of curiosity and the enjoyment of reasonable adventure. Okay? So there's more than the fourth adjutant, right? It now has this top-down, spiritualizing. So it's that spirit of knowledge.
And how interesting, too, that the long talk with this father concerning the manner in which various groups of living things are born into the world as separate individuals, that this specific functioning of the first cosmic intuition in terms of point-like logical acumen, the midwayers happen to reference this birth of an individual, separate individuals, in the functioning of what you're fleshing out here.
Right. And I see all that scientific precision, see the way that, that was stated there. Right? It almost becomes a mouthful to say because it has so much scientific precision in it, right? But then notice another element, that came up at the end of that paragraph, right? His parents, helped him to reach a satisfactory solution.
Yes.
Look at that next favorable condition there in paper 100. Right? After the exercise of curiosity and the enjoyment of reasonable adventure being soil essential for religious growth, also the experiencing of feelings of satisfaction.
Wow.
Okay. So you see those two elements, right? Right before your eyes, and we see young Jesus, unfolding the soil that's essential for religious growth. Scientific curiosity, and the ability to come to a satisfactory resolution of a situation. Even if it's not some sort of absolute answer, right? But it has a relative wholeness to it and is satisfying.
Yeah.
As you mature, you'll have to, get a new and improved wholeness, okay? But nonetheless, those two are right there. So, with you're reading this, as a scientist, I'm really interested in it. It's like, no. The don't think of science as an end in itself. Right? That scientific curiosity is soil that's essential for religious growth. So that's what's so unfortunate about the 19th century being followed by an endarkenment, is you establish all of this wonderful soil for religious growth, and then it's squandered.
Or worse, it's poisoned. I'm thinking of where I used to work. There were many terrific parents, at least in potential, highly educated, very intelligent people who saw this moment with their young children. Oh, scientific curiosity. But they said, well, that's the end unto itself. And then the child might start doing what David told us earlier, asking religious questions. And that those old coworkers of mine said, no, we don't ask those questions. That's just old superstition. Back to the science.
So that you, when you see the how question coming to a child's mind, right, the scientific question, that's going to be followed by a philosophic question of why.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's the kind of thought that leads you Godward. The why question.
Yeah.
If you short circuit that, right, then that child is probably not going to survive. You know, unless something comes around in their life that allows them to do like Jesus said. It's like, okay, so just kind of erase all those current years of your life and go back to basically six and try starting over again?
Right.
Right. Because if you don't, right, if you don't take the humanism and secularism and throw it out the window, right, you can't really enter the kingdom as that little child. But it becomes more and more difficult for someone to just say, oh, well, that was all a big whatever. Let me go back to this, square one, reset. No, they've come to cherish some of these things that are more recent in their life than, subsequent to age six. And they begin to exhibit a devotion to the godless ideals of those things.
One other quick thing to add in 101, in that paragraph, they also bring up this stimulus of attention and awareness. And at the end of paragraph 3, they talk about his alert mind. And when you're talking about that first cosmic intuition, you're thinking of bringing something to a focus point. And it's logical that that has to be first in the sequence. When you're learning to play a phrase, you first have to understand the nuances of each individual note and the differentials of those notes before you can begin to synthesize or have a bigger picture of a phrase. So that has to be the first step in the process.
Yeah, and again, we talked about that one before. And by the way, it's paper 100, not 101.
Oh, sorry, 100, section 1. Sorry, I didn't specify,
Right, if you're going to begin to have that scientific curiosity, which is predicated on the unnatural focusing of your mind, via your first cosmic intuition, but if there's no predicate for focusing, right, you're not going to willfully focus. Right? I mean, your mind has to have an inclination to focusing. That's where the functioning of the fear stimulus of attention and awareness comes in. Right? I mean, that's, before Jesus could begin to manifest this, budding use of the first cosmic intuition, right, there had to be that animal focusing of his mind, right? He's familiar with, the positive consequences, if you will, of being focused on something, right? The fear stimulus is the way God designed us to back into the using of the first cosmic intuition.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's just, again, if there's been such, a sheltered life, you never really have learned how, what happens when you focus your mind, it's no wonder that a lot of, people growing up in that environment, kind of just all fuzzed out and, sought bliss in the name of seeking truth and seeking God.
I can see that. Well,
anyway,
one of the rare moments I'll be thankful for being a rather nervous, neurotic child. A lot of focus. All right, there we go.
All
I got that going for me.
All good things taken to extreme become bad, though, Brad. Okay, so
I'm a walking testament to that.
Guilty.
Since returning to Nazareth, theirs had been a busy household, and Joseph had been unusually occupied building his new shop and getting his business started again. So fully was he occupied that he had found no time to build a cradle for James, but this was corrected long before Miriam came, so that she had a very comfortable crib in which to nestle while the family admired her. And the child Jesus heartily entered into all these natural and normal home experiences. He greatly enjoyed his little brother and his baby sister and was of great help to Mary in their care.
So, yes, very early on, Jesus could change diapers.
Precocious.
Yeah, but of course some of this, it seems precocious now, but again, it used to be you know, children were just brought up in an environment where they became a lot more focused on practical things earlier on.
We talked about this on the parallel podcast that we have going here, and we talked about even a 5-year-old should be able to set the table for dinner, and that's participating in the orderliness of a home. I mean, even if they're not going to change diapers, surely they could put a fork on a napkin. That could help.
They're pointing out that, you know, all of these basic things of having a crib and everyone gathering around and oogling the new baby, and again, you don't want to think, oh, that's all just silly animal emotional stuff. We're going to be serious, you know, about God and stuff or whatever. It's like, no, that's a, you know, they're trying to just point out that, you know, don't go all ascetic, you know, the moment you start having a religious inclination. You know, and it's like, no one should have a crib, and no one should smile, and, right. I mean, it's problematic enough in these Jewish homes, you know, that you have these notions about art, you know, as false gods and all that sort of stuff, right?
Sure.
Yeah, so they're trying to temper that.
We'll get to that on year 9.
Right. There were few homes in the Gentile world of those days that could give a child a better intellectual, moral, and religious training than the Jewish homes of Galilee. These Jews had a systematic program for rearing and educating their children. They divided a child's life into 7 stages. 1, the newborn child, the first to the 8th day. 2, the suckling child. 3, the weaned child. 4, the period of dependence on the mother lasting up to the end of the 5th year. 5, the beginning independence of the child, and with sons, the father assuming responsibility for their education. 6, the adolescent youths and maidens. 7, the young men and the young women.
All right. We were talking about a religious environment. It gets very definitive come the 8th day of life. That's if you're a male, that's when you get circumcised. So that whole presentation in the temple, that also is for male children, that's when they're circumcised. We all know, you know, how this ties into a lot of primitive notions and stuff, as the Revelators explain in other parts of the book. But nonetheless, right, you know, it's the whole point of it is, again, that you are trying to have some very overt statement of how you are not natural. You're trying to be unnatural. You're trying to, you know, identify with God, not man. You know, and certainly not animal. In that little predicate, you know, notice their very obvious 3-word sequence there. Could give a child a better intellectual, moral, and religious training.
Hey, that sounds familiar.
In other words, a training that is attempting to have things based upon the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd cosmic intuitions, respectively. To begin to train a child, right? The purpose of education, that is to develop and sharpen the relationship to those 3 cosmic intuitions, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and there you see them, 1, 2, 3. That scientific consciousness, right, is the predicate for, you know, something that isn't just a mentality, but an intellectuality.
And then
the moral consciousness on the 5th, and the, you know, spiritual insight, the religious consciousness on the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
This reminds me in paper 137, section 8, paragraph 9, where Jesus is talking with the apostles for one of the first times about the kingdom of heaven. And the ending sentence says, and this kingdom of God is righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit. And it's one of the first footholds that he kind of gives to the 12 in regards to the kingdom of heaven. And he brings up specifically the elements of righteousness and the Holy Spirit, speaking to you know, what we're talking about right now with the cosmic intuitions.
Yeah.
Right. Again, it's you don't start with the Spirit of Truth. You don't start with the adjuster. You start with the Holy Spirit and the exercising of your personality, to lift the animal up out of the ooze. And like we've been saying, that you can't imagine, you can't be delusionally imagining that a child bootstraps themselves up like this. No, they have to be trained. If there isn't intellectual, moral, and religious training, then there isn't intellectuality, morality, and religion.
Yeah. This is the part I just want to quickly make my weirdest, most tangential cross-reference of some time. This reminds me of the United States Northwest Ordinance, where it says, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. You see, people have known this for a long time.
Yeah. And like we were talking up front, this systematic program. I mean, and the fact that you can point out Shakespeare. We can point out this Jewish tradition. Or we can note, as we did last week, that these papers of this arc about Jesus of Nazareth are laid out systematically.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There are these stages, they're innate in what constitutes a human. Right? There's matter. There's two phases of life animation. There's mechanical mind. There's seven mind adjutants. There's an encirclement of the Holy Spirit. Three cosmic intuitions. There's a personality, etc. And that all, that whole complex system systematically rolls out.
Right.
You are, as a parent of a child, you're parenting something that's been designed. Right? And so, I often use this kind of male analogy, if you're an automobile repairman, you're not going to have much success in fixing the person's car when they bring it in if you don't think that what's under the hood was designed.
Right. Yeah. Simple, lovely analogy.
Right. So that child that you give, birth to is a design. And the more you understand its God-based design, the more that you can truly parent and foster the unfolding of that design. Or you could instill a developing antagonism to God's order in that child.
All right. Anything else to say about the seven different periods? There's obviously plenty more in there.
Yeah. We're about to talk about it a little bit here next. But we can just think about how the actual sequence, right, that we've already brought up a couple times earlier tonight, that lays out in these papers with Jesus as the example. It overcomes the arbitrariness of things like, as Jews we think there's something definitive about newborn to the eighth day. It's like why?
Right. Because of a temple, because of a pageant. Yes.
It's like, well, because, you know, seven is the number of completeness. And, you know, right?
Sure.
I mean, to overcome, you know, some of these, you know, early attempts of humans to lay out the science of the order. But, you know, but just to notice that there's something in humans where they know there's a sequence. You know, even if they can't figure out the specifics themselves, and that has to be revealed to you. Right? But even without revelation, humans, you know, have, you know, as the centuries, as the millennia roll on, he's like, you know, there's something about 16, and there's something about 8, and et cetera. Right?
Yeah.
We, you know, we slowly, you know, have been picking up on God's order.
Sure. Or even one family, if they have multiple children, then by the time they're late, their youngest one goes along, they're like, okay, they're 16. We know what's next. Especially because they share genetics. Yeah. You can just start to notice the patterns. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a good point. Let's see. Dave, would you like to take the reading from here?
Of course. Thank you, Fred. It was the custom of the Galilean Jews for the mother to bear the responsibility for a child's training until the fifth birthday. And then, if the child were a boy, to hold the father responsible for the lad's education from that time on. This year, therefore, Jesus entered upon the fifth stage of a Galilean Jewish child's career, and accordingly, on August 21st, 2 BC, Mary formally turned him over to Joseph for further instruction.
No day of the week there. notice how they were specific, the Galilean Jews. Right? So you go, oh, so there's probably other, you know, you can imagine. I'll bet you there's some of them that, where, you know, they don't allow the mother to have that much influence. You can imagine that there's some issues like that. Right? But again, you know, just as, you know, all those sorts of things, you know, and sometimes the arbitrariness of where they're drawing boundary lines. Right. I mean, they're thinking about that, you know, that, well, okay, it isn't random that there's a mother and a father.
No.
So why did God make mothers and fathers, and why did he make them different? And how is that difference important to a child, you know, becoming something that hungers and thirsts for righteousness. Right, so they're trying, yeah, to see the truth of that. How, you know, these are people that are earnestly, right, seeking to strike step with what they see as God's order, being very respectful of that.
An image comes to mind of like Mary, like, literally holding Joseph to the responsibility of the lad's education. I wonder why they worded it like that.
Great point. You know, remember that if this child has any antisocial issues, who's going to be responsible? It's like, well, if that's a male and it's after their fifth birthday, it's the father's fault.
Mm.
He should have done something he didn't do, and hence this child is a problem to the community. Right, so, you know, see, not just holding the child responsible for them, you know, their antisocial behavior, right, but holding the parents responsible for not raising them properly.
Well, that's not politically correct, Chris. So.
It's intriguing, yeah.
Though Joseph was now assuming the direct responsibility for Jesus' intellectual and religious education, his mother still interested herself in his home training. She taught him to know and care for the vines and flowers growing about the garden walls, which completely surrounded the home plot. She also provided on the roof of the house, the summer bedroom, shallow boxes of sand in which Jesus worked out maps and did much of his early practice at writing Aramaic, Greek, and later on Hebrew, for in time he learned to read, write, and speak fluently all three languages.
Isn't just poking with your thumbs and making, you know, various, you know, emojis and stuff adequate? Notice there, right? You know, we saw the intellectual, moral, and religious, you know, all three. Notice that, you know, there's just two here. Yeah. So, you know, what are they hinting at, right? About, you know, remember that, you know, the first cosmic intuition and the third cosmic intuition are tied to the two foundational elements, and then the second is tied to the super additive consequence of the relationship between the other two.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, yeah, when they, you know, see, you know, they set you up so that when you see it here, you notice, like, here they want you to think about the, you know, the physics of that super additive, right? And that, you know, the fullness of a moral consciousness is the super additive consequence of the relationship between that scientific consciousness and that religious consciousness.
Hmm. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, the reason and the faith moving up to logic, yes.
And if you think about morality properly, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, that makes complete sense. It's not, you know, it doesn't all come from one side or the other.
Hmm.
That's why if you have a secular individual, good luck on the morality thing being in play.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus appeared to be physically and continued to make normal progress mentally and emotionally. He experienced a mild digestive upset, his first minor illness, in the later part of his fifth calendar year. Though Joseph and Mary often talked about the future of their eldest child, had you been there, you would only have observed the growing up of a normal, healthy, carefree, and exceedingly inquisitive child of that time and place.
So you just, you know, want us to do two paragraphs at once, I see.
He doesn't want to talk about digestive upset.
I didn't realize. I'm sorry.
It hits a little close to home to talk about digestive upset with kids.
But, you know, just putting those two together there. Think about the physics of, you know, when there's how they word things, right? You have the foundational, you know, it's just the child physically, you know, the basic zeroth level of meaning, you know, the life animated matter and the mechanical mind, and then the first, you know, level of meaning, you know, quote unquote mentally, and the second level of meaning, you know, emotionally. Right? I mean, so all of that kind of just bottom up, you know, maturation, right? It continues to make normal progress. You know, so you have this, you know, you have a continued upwelling, but more and more there is a willful downwelling, you know, that's meeting that from above. He's making more and more use of his encirclement in the Holy Spirit. Notice again at the very end, you know, I mean, but exceedingly inquisitive. And again, that's that, you know, he's showing a man, you know, the fruits of his relationship to the first cosmic intuition very precociously.
Yes.
He is exceeding. That's one of those adverbs you can just miss here. But, yeah, that he's far above the average. He's exceeding. Yeah.
But, again, just, you know, it's you know, to recognize, like, that's why we went back to paper 100, that early manifestation of using the first cosmic intuition, right, in a noticeable way, right, is foreshadowing someone who's going to achieve great religious heights.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, in other words, he's not just going to become a religionist. He's going to become a religionist of philosophic attainment. Right? And by the time he's a third circler, you're reading those papers, you have things like the Discourse on Reality and stuff. Okay. And so, yeah, that ability to, they tell you in other places of the book. I mean, you can still have that basic religious nature, but it's not going to go anywhere in this life beyond that starting point of being born again, because you didn't have these this essential soil for religious growth.
Mm.
You might have had enough to become a religionist, okay, but not, not one that's going to really grow here. They're going to have to grow in the mansion world into a religionist of philosophic attainment.
Well, I'm looking forward to that reasonable adventure up there. Three events of the sixth year, 1 BC. Already with his mother's help, Jesus had mastered the Galilean dialect of the Aramaic tongue, and now his father began teaching him Greek. Mary spoke little Greek, but Joseph was a fluent speaker of both Aramaic and Greek. The textbook for the study of the Greek language was the copy of the Hebrew Scriptures, a complete version of the Law and the Prophets, including the Psalms, which had been presented to them on leaving Egypt. There were only two complete copies of this scripture in Greek in all Nazareth, and the possession of one of them by the carpenter's family made Joseph's home a much sought place and enabled Jesus, as he grew up, to meet an almost endless procession of earnest students and sincere truth seekers. Before this year ended, Jesus had assumed custody of this priceless manuscript, having been told on his sixth birthday that the sacred book had been presented to him by Alexandrian friends and relatives. In a very short time, he could read it readily.
Yeah, your typical six-year-old.
Right.
But see, again, I mean, how much he is already, in motion, relative to a significant religious future. And, and he's getting, these people streaming in and out of the house that hunger for truth and thirst for righteousness. So, again, the loyalty that, that those people exhibit, right, by just coming to his house. He doesn't have to, talk to them one time or anything. Him knowing that these people came all, from far away. They hunger and thirst so that, he's just all of these favorable conditions for someone that's going to, do more than get to the starting block.
Yeah, and to talk about precocious, though not inside of his own mind, like their household had they owned a printed book, like something that wouldn't become common for 1,800 more years, even in the 19th century in the world here today. They were still relatively rare. Most people only had a Bible. They were expensive. And here he's got one. I mean, that's civilizationally precocious for him to have that. How fortuitous.
The Septuagint that we're talking about here, and they say a complete copy. So in other words, his Hebrew Scriptures was actually a bigger tome than the current Old Testament.
Right.
I love how they speak to the significance of the social aspect, too, of all these sincere truth seekers and students, this endless procession of them coming to visit. I mean, he was in a world and in an environment where he was exposed to that amount of people that early on that had to play a huge influence on him.
Yeah, and obviously, a six-year-old that is taking things seriously enough that you can trust them with a priceless manuscript.
Right.
you know, obviously there's going to be, you know, some issues further down where he's, you know, he's going to need to balance out so that he doesn't become just, you know, overly serious, you know, a humorless moralist.
Mm.
Right? I mean, you know, but it's important to, you know, start it out where what needs to happen is, you know, is a little bit of tempering, right? You know, you see, again, it's the natural order. You set the sixth adjutant rolling, you know, and then as you mature, you learn how to put a bridle on it and pull back on the reins some with the seventh adjutant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but it's important to, you know, to have the wild horse first. Right. And
yeah.
So you see this natural part of his development.
Yeah.
Hmm. Let's see
he
what this baby can
to...
do, kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
What was that, Brad?
Let's see what this baby can do, and kind of figure it out with a spin, then figure out how to handle it responsibly.
Let's take her up to 88.
There's always that issue with whether or not young males will survive to adulthood.
right. Yes, thank God he had that and he was able to develop spiritual fruits and didn't turn him into nuts, being a spiritual nut. The first great shock of Jesus' young life occurred when he was not quite 6 years old. It had seemed to the lad that his father, at least his father and mother together, knew everything. Imagine, therefore, the surprise of this inquiring child when he asked his father the cause of a mild earthquake, which had just occurred, to hear Joseph say, "My son, I really do not know." Thus began that long and disconcerting disillusionment, course of which Jesus found out that his earthly parents were not all-wise and all-knowing.
You know, and again, you know, you've got this scientific, you know, curiosity, like we've talked about already. And again, notice the pattern of, you know, you have, you know, initially an appropriate, immature, runaway idealism that then needs to get disillusioned, you know, and properly framed, conditioned, right? But again, you can't mature something that doesn't exist.
Right.
So you can't philosophically frame your ideals if they don't exist first. You can't face facts and adjust them to ideals without first having ideals, like we talked about here, you know, before. And so you see that natural development where his parents didn't short-circuit his idealism early on. You know, in due time, disillusionment will come around, right? The Supreme will see to appropriate disillusionment, you know, and he's going to have the ability to deal with it. It's not going to crush him when, you know, disconcerting disillusionment finally rolls around in due time.
Well, yeah, another way to look at it, it's probably just the same thing through a slightly different lens. They talk about over in paper 177, the child must derive first impressions of the universe from the mother, and the earthly father gives first ideas of the heavenly father. So it seems like any child, certainly not just an incarnated creator son, is going to have this disillusionment. Oh, my parents are not God. They're not all wise, all knowing. I better go in search of the real God.
Yeah, see, right, exactly, that this disillusionement isn't horizontal. There's a vertical component. You know, the child doesn't throw out the concept of ideals. They go, oh, I was putting the ideals on too low a level.
Right, right.
Right, and then you get disillusioned again. Oh, I put the ideals on too low a level. And then they get disillusioned. Right. It's a process, right, to finally recognize, you know, that the ideals are predicated on eternity, right? So, right, that process, that's what I meant by he's going to work through it. You know, he won't just become, you know, bitter and, you know, and prosaic. He's going to take the ideals up to a more appropriate level.
Justin, would you like to take over reading?
Sure thing. Thanks, David.
Of course.
Joseph's first thought was to tell Jesus that the earthquake had been caused by God, but a moment's reflection admonished him that such an answer would immediately be provocative of further and still more embarrassing inquiries. Even at an early age, it was very difficult to answer Jesus' questions about physical or social phenomena by thoughtlessly telling him that either God or the devil was responsible. In harmony with the prevailing belief of the Jewish people, Jesus was long willing to accept the doctrine of good spirits and evil spirits as the possible explanation of mental and spiritual phenomena, but he very early became doubtful that such unseen influences were responsible for the physical happenings of the natural world.
Again, that first cosmic intuition, is kicking in very solidly early on. The stuff beyond the immediate physical, is initially not so clear in your mind. There needs to be some understanding, right? Because we pointed out before, there has to be this sort of, initial satisfaction. You can't mature. There's no religious growth of a mind that's in sort of utter disruption. So there has to be, this relative satisfaction, and the challenge should start with the physical and work its way up until eventually you won't accept anything short of the fifth epical revelation of God the Father.
Yeah, well
where
stated.
Logically, God has to be based upon something that's transcendent of reality. He has to be based on deity. Things like that, right? Way up the philosophic hierarchy, right? Instead of dual spiritism.
Well, quickly, thinking back to those former coworkers of mine, well-educated scientists of the present moment, I'm sure they were quite skilled at helping to cultivate the first cosmic intuition. I'm just saying what I said earlier again. I can see them certainly not allowing superstition. The devil and the angels do those physical things. But what they probably were not skilled at was then helping the child lead them up into those other realms, the non-physical. They probably tried to reduce everything down to the physical.
Not to mention, back 2,000 years ago here, Jesus is this young boy, there literally were good spirits and evil spirits.
They actually did do physical things, right? And they got into people's minds. Weird.
No, there is that also.
Yeah, you had to be there. Yeah.
Before Jesus was 6 years of age, in the early summer of 1 BC, Zacharias and Elizabeth and their son John came to visit the Nazareth family. Jesus and John had a happy time during this, their first visit within their memories. Although the visitors could remain only a few days, the parents talked over many things, including the future plans for their sons. While they were thus engaged, the lads played with blocks in the sand on top of the house and in many other ways enjoyed themselves in true boyish fashion.
Again, just noticed I'm pointing out that there are, Mary's instincts are helping right at the very beginning so that he doesn't become overly serious.
Right.
He's a boy. If you build a sandbox and give him some blocks, he'll focus on that instead of, I think I really, should, read Ecclesiastes one more time today.
That comes later, Too bad they didn't have bulldozers. Man, he would have loved bulldozers. Those were great in sandboxes.
And you notice them happy again.
Having met John, who came from near Jerusalem, Jesus began to evince an unusual interest in the history of Israel and to inquire in great detail as to the meaning of the Sabbath rites, the synagogue sermons, and the recurring feasts of commemoration. His father explained to him the meaning of all these seasons. The first was the midwinter festival, Illumination, lasting 8 days, starting out with one candle the first night and adding one each successive night. This commemorated the dedication of the temple after the restoration of the Mosaic services by Judas Maccabee. Next came the early springtime celebration of Purim, the feast of Esther and Israel's deliverance through her. Then followed the solemn Passover, which the adults celebrated in Jerusalem whenever possible. While at home, the children would remember that no leavened bread was to be eaten for the whole week. Later came the feast of the first fruits, the harvest ingathering, and last, the most solemn of all, the feast of the new year, the Day of Atonement. While some of these celebrations and observances were difficult for Jesus' young mind to understand, he pondered them seriously and then entered fully into the joy of the Feast of Tabernacles, the annual vacation season of the whole Jewish people, the time when they camped out in leafy booths and gave themselves up to mirth and pleasure.
So, you know, notice again, see, just what I was pointing out about the boyish fashion stuff before. He's exposed to this through John. His parents are, you know, very serious about all this. And, you know, he evinces an unusual interest, right? And, and then mentioning he pondered them seriously. And see, so you can see, you know, he could potentially become overly serious, right?
Right.
So between, Mary, for instance, helping to temper this, and then look at that. It's built right into the Jewish system that you have the Feast of Tabernacles. It's like, okay, everyone, just chill out a little bit, okay? Okay, and how about some mirth and pleasure here? Because we can all get too serious about this.
During this year,
Something I really keyed in here, it says his father explained to him the meaning of all these seasons, not just the facts of them. So they weren't just dead rituals that he needed to memorize rote, but like the living meaning of them. I think he gave them a dynamic quality, which could make them really come to life.
Yes, because Joseph is responsible for his religious education.
Yeah.
And if Jesus, you know, grows up not fully understanding all this, everyone is going to look at and point their fingers at Joseph as a failure as a father. Joseph is responsible.
During this year, Joseph and Mary had trouble with Jesus about his prayers. He insisted on talking to his heavenly father, much as he would talk to Joseph, his earthly father. This departure from the more solemn and reverent modes of communication with deity was a bit disconcerting to his parents, especially to his mother. But there was no persuading him to change. He would say his prayers just as he had been taught, after which he insisted on having just a little talk with my father in heaven.
Besides the the wonderful little example of his precociousness, you know, in beginning to transcend ritual there, you know, and thinking of just a little talk with my father in heaven. You know, notice you had the mention of communication with deity there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, notice it's not the universal father, it's just Father, right? So, you know, you see them, you know, the midwares, you know, bringing out that fact that we're talking about your upper domain of your personalized self of spiritualized mind synchronizing with deity, as opposed to thinking, you know, in external reality terms.
Mm.
But then also, notice he would say his prayers just as he had been taught, after which, okay, you know, we'll get that, you know, a further example of that in a moment here. What do you see very clearly, right? You've got seven commandments, right, coming down from the prince's staff. The seventh of those is, you shall not show disrespect for your parents and elders.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you have a moral consciousness. Right, but you also have an individual who, is on a very aggressive upward path and will pass his parents, you know, in short order.
And that upward path is connected to what you touched on earlier with the levels of disillusionment when they mentioned his earthly parents were not all wise and all knowing. He's already come to that recognition, and that's why he's comfortable with just a little talk with Mary. Father,
not to mention, he's got both the religious and the intellectual. There's the differential, so there's a super additive consequence. He's an individual that's going upward.
Yes. In June of this year, Joseph turned the shop in Nazareth over to his brothers and formally entered upon his work as a builder. Before the year was over, the family income had more than trebled. Never again until after Joseph's death did the Nazareth family feel the pinch of poverty. The family grew larger and larger, and they spent much money on extra education and travel, but always Joseph's increasing income kept pace with the growing expenses.
You know, the obvious thing that, it's not like you should seek a life where there's nothing but negative stimuli that you have to somehow have a positive response to.
Yeah.
Right. You know, the point isn't asceticism, right, to achieve happiness. You actually have something that really wasn't a thing, you know, a kind of a middle class sort of a life, right, for a little while. Days, you didn't really have a middle class.
Mm-hmm.
The next few years, Joseph did considerable work at Cana, Bethlehem of Galilee, Magdala, Nain, Sepphoris, Capernaum, and Endor, as well as much building in and near Nazareth. As James grew up to be old enough to help his mother with the housework and care of the younger children, Jesus made frequent trips away from the home with his father to these surrounding towns and villages. Jesus was a keen observer and gained much practical knowledge from these trips away from home. He was assiduously storing up knowledge regarding man and the way he lived on earth.
Again, look at knowledge, the scientific. You know, he's sure. Becoming a very definitive scientific individual. Assiduously storing up.
We see that later in his life. I was just reading the other night. He was, they were in, was it Joppa? Or right along the coast, and he was explaining to Gained like how the waterworks worked there. I'm like, what is Jesus doing understanding the waterworks of a major port city? Well, he's just assiduously observing life.
And in terms of the geography there, I mean, those are just the towns and villages immediately around Nazareth and over to the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. So the immediate environs there.
This year, Jesus made great progress in adjusting his strong feelings and vigorous impulses to the demands of family cooperation and home discipline. Mary was a loving mother, but a fairly strict disciplinarian. In many ways, however, Joseph exerted the greater control over Jesus, as it was his practice to sit down with the boy and fully explain the real and underlying reasons for the necessity of disciplinary curtailment of personal desires in deference to the welfare and tranquility of the entire family. When the situation had been explained to Jesus, he was always intelligently and willingly cooperative with parental wishes and family regulations.
So again, not only do you have the the seventh commandment of the seven commandments, right, playing out there. But, you know, in this, you know, young boy, you know, you can explain it and he can get above all the details and see it logically. Again, that, you know, that first cosmic intuition is, you know, is beginning to have holistic consequences, right? He's going beyond logical acumen to logic.
Yeah.
Not to mention the opening there, you know, is yet another of the, you know, the favorable conditions of the soil essential for religious growth, you know, the coordination of natural propensities that we saw there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's also beginning to think like abstractly,
yeah,
which seems way odd for someone so young.
Yeah, again, see, once, you know, if you start getting that holistic mode of the upper domain, that, you know, that holistic logic mode, I mean, there are many things that are just innate in that, including the ability to begin to think abstractly.
Much of his spare time, when his mother did not require his help about the house, was spent studying the flowers and plants by day and the stars by night. He invented a troublesome penchant for lying on his back and gazing wonderingly up into the starry heavens long after his usual bedtime in this well-ordered Nazareth household.
Talk about scientific curiosity. So, you know, we have a budding botanist and an astronomer here. Hey. Yeah, not to mention, you know, later in his life, he had to have, you know, chuckled to himself as he thought back. You know, little did he know as a little boy, you know, that when you're laying there looking, you know, with your naked eyes at the heavens, you know, other than the Milky Way, every star that you're looking at are the stars in Nebadon.
Mm.
He's looking at his
yeah.
local universe.
You made that. Yeah. you manage that. Yeah. You're sovereign over that.
There's a little
something
bit of
something intriguingly familiar about what I'm looking at.
There's a little bit of a tone of courageous and independent in the way that they phrase this after his usual bedtime in this well-ordered Nazareth household. He has these limits, but he's still finding time to look up at the heavens.
Right. I mean, again, the lower domain is going to conform, okay? But the upper domain, you know, is hungry.
Yes.
I mean, in recent times, the imagery that comes to mind there are little boys in their bedrooms under the sheets with the flashlight reading Hardy Boy mysteries or something. Not exactly like astronomy, but still hungry, and they're just going to stay up after bedtime.
Yeah, my youthful story is, you know, okay, I had to go to bed, you know, but there was company over. And so, you know, I would technically be in the bed, but I'd be at the foot of the bed, which is this, and I'm leaning over trying to listen to what was going on, you know. Out there in the living room. I wanted to hear what the adults were talking about. Yeah. I was told I had to do it. I had to stay in bed. So I was technically in bed.
Well ordered.
Yes. Right. But, yeah. So that, but see that, you know, that insatiable hunger, right? See, it's fundamentally, see, it's that scientific curiosity. You know, that's someone who can eventually hunger and thirst for righteousness when they have that scientific curiosity as a predicate.
How terrific, how delightful it must be when you have children of your own and to see that just naturally budding in them. Oh, just, you know, so rewarding. Mm. All right, well, we'll have to leave it there for this Tuesday. Another fine study, very, very enjoyable this evening. So much rich material in here. Come back again next Tuesday or join us on our new podcast, which releases new episodes on Fridays. Until then, follow the way.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great night, and thank you for sharing your one talent of time with us.
Take care, everyone.
Yes, take care, everyone. Everyone, enjoy your week. We'll see you next week.